special man, steak for the sun, wine for the woman who made the rain come. Seagulls, sing your hearts away as wild sinners sin, the children play. Oh Lord, how they play and play for that happy day, for that happy day.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio. Welcome back. It is January 28th, 2006. This week, we continue our discussion with Melinda Leslie on military abductions, also known as MILABs, and general harassment of abductees at the hands of this shadowy government powers-that-be type structure that, is studying the ET phenomenon. If you haven't heard the first part of the interview, we posted it last week at BenallofAmerica.com. I highly suggest you check that out for Melinda's background and her general thesis on the MILAB scenario. But you're here right now for this week's installment, the conclusion of our discussion. We're talking about what other abduction researchers say about the MILAB phenomenon, patterns that emerge from various abductees who've been harassed by the government, what areas she finds most troubling about the phenomenon. We have an in-depth discussion of the minders, these folks that manage to worm their way into the lives of abductees and attempt to steer them in one direction or the other. And that's a fascinating discussion. And from there, we move on to a really chilling story of her co-author's ordeal at the hands of the powers that be. Plus tons more. Stepford abductees, a big discussion on disclosure, and women in ufology. I get Melinda's perspective on that. So all that is about to play out right now in your ears. For those of you unfamiliar with Melinda Leslie, here's a little bit about her. She has investigated covert intelligence involvement in abductions for 12 years, conducted over 40 interviews of experiencers and researchers of this troubling phenomenon. For many years, Melinda was the director of two experiencer support groups and the director of a monthly lecture series for 9 years, presenting nearly 100 speakers. Melinda was associate producer of the 1994 UFO Expo West conferences, has lectured on her area of expertise at numerous conferences, and has been a guest on many radio and television talk shows. So, without any further ado, let's take it away. Melinda Leslie, Part 2 of 2 on Benall of America Audio, Season 1. This interview was recorded on January 14th, 2006. Now, in your presentation, you do spend some time talking about other abductee researchers, sort of like the big names in the field and what they have to say about military, the MILAB aspect of abduction. So why don't you speak to that a little bit, because I'm sure people know about the other abductee researchers and maybe haven't heard them say much about it, and obviously you know what they have to say about it, so...
Well, and different ones say different things. Some are quite open about it and include it in their research, and others include it in their research but aren't open about it, and some don't even include it in their research and aren't open about it. So it's all those levels. As far as like the major researchers, unfortunately, John Mack is no longer with us.
Yeah.
I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of that.
Yeah.
But John Mack, who was chair of the psychiatric department at Harvard Medical School and was a major abduction researcher, had cases of this and shared that with me, and we had even planned on doing future work together on this subject. He had had a number of cases, and I just have had someone referred to me recently that I need to call and haven't called, but a researcher gave me the number of someone and told me this was another case of John Max. So it's like, oh, okay, I was familiar with four or five, and here's another, so now I'm familiar with like six, But this was another case of someone who'd worked with John, who'd had these experiences. And John Mack, luckily, Dr. Mack was very open to this. He was reserved in going public with it because it was something new to him. He wanted to look at it further. And, you know, most of the major abduction researchers, when they write a book or do a lecture, they know they're talking to the lowest common denominator as far as knowledge on the subject, you know, John Q. Public. And so they kind of have to start with square one, like, is alien abduction real, and what's happening, and is it traumatic for the people, and, you know, and they're dealing with that.
Yeah.
And the healing aspect of helping someone through the discovery process, you know, that's what they're dealing with. And that's understandable, because that's what they do, and when they lecture to a crowd, they're talking about that. And they might be talking about the evidence for that as far as medical evidence, implant removals and the scars and, you know, and maybe ground trace evidence. So this kind of thing. But this particular aspect is one of those things that's not so prevalent in their overall research, so they don't need to address it publicly, and that's not what they're there to do. It doesn't mean they didn't have cases of it.
Yeah.
A lot of the abduction researchers have multiple cases of this, and some have more than others, depending on their openness and their knowledge of it and their willingness to look at it. John had at least a handful, maybe a couple handfuls of cases of this, where he said these people are reporting the harassment, surveillance, and they've reported being interrogated by guys in military uniforms, and you know this kind of stuff. And most of the major abduction researchers have had some cases of this. Certainly, the numbers go up with the low-grade harassment, surveillance, black helicopter stuff. A lot of the abduction researchers will say, "Yeah, my cases have had helicopter stuff. They've had phone stuff, but they haven't had the re-abduction." And some have said, "Yeah, you know, I have, you know, 12 cases, 20 cases, 200 cases with the re-abduction."
Yeah.
But you know, but that's out of 500 cases overall, you know, that they've worked with. And as they become more educated about it, they see it more. And like I've talked to them, and I've had abduction researchers, even in conversation with me, go, you know what, I have had more cases of this. Now, some abduction researchers, like John, who worked with quite a few, some have worked with it quite a bit and have multiple cases of it. Three people instantly, well, I can think of a bunch of people that come to mind, but known abduction researchers who come to mind off the top of my head that are fairly well known is Leo Sprinkle, who's had many cases of this, has worked with people extensively who've had the military stuff. Like I said, Leo Sprinkle, John Carpenter is another one, Barbara Lamb is another one. These people have had multiple cases, you know, where people have had the military stuff. And again, sometimes it's the low-grade stuff, you know, like, I think Leo Sprinkle told me, I'd have to look at some notes here, but I think just off the top of my head that he had had like 200 cases of harassment surveillance kind of stuff, but as far as out and outright re-abduction interrogation, I think at the time I talked to him, this was a number of years ago, but he had like, I think he said 12 cases of the re-abduction, you know.
Yeah.
You know, where they were literally taken by the military kind of thing.
So that kind of speaks to your idea that as it progresses,
yes.
To like as they sort of filter
exactly.
out till they get to the ones they're looking for.
Exactly. Because if they're going to spend the time and energy and risk involvement with you, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you know, it must be a risk-cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
I can talk in business terms.
Yeah.
But the risk-cost-benefit analysis, you know, they must really got to want to do it to bother and go through the hassle of doing it.
Yeah.
So they have to have an interest in you. And like I said, come up with all sorts of patterns as to why they would be more interested in one as opposed to another. And it's everything from your family history and background to what might have happened in your experiences, to your lifestyle. I mean, there's a whole, all these factors that can be considered, you know.
Now, I noticed also from what you had to say before was that there seems to be a fear of revealing the MyLab even to the abduction researchers. Would you say that's come up, that the abductees, they'll go and they'll talk about their abduction experience, but then they'll hold back on the military abduction aspect?
Yes, absolutely. Usually the abductee is just trying to wrap their head around the fact they've had the alien experience. And if they've had this other part, usually the abductee, it takes the abductee a while to even be willing to look at that's happened to them. I mean, they may have it there, and they have conscious memory of it, but it's like they can't deal with it.
Yeah.
It's too much. And it, when they go to seek out help with their alien experiences, they're looking usually for help with the trauma or help with confusing memories. So they either have disjointed confusing memories or some degree of trauma, and it's surfacing some way in their life that's making life difficult for them, or a medical challenge or something like this that causes them to seek out someone who's worked with abductees, mm-hmm. because they just want to know, did this happen to me? Yeah. Did this happen? And how do I live with it? You know, and that's what you start with. Did this happen and how do I live with it? And usually, also, like we were saying, it's usually down the road that they even have the military aspect. When that happens, they're like, okay, people are already going to think I'm crazy. Now they're going to be convinced I'm crazy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a tendency, even though they may have told people they know, family members or friends or UFO researchers about their alien experiences, they're not going to bring up the military part because they think that this is going to discredit me. You know, I'm walking on a thin line already.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go there.
Exactly.
And so when they, usually if they're meeting with someone who's going to do regressive hypnosis on them, like, you know, an abduction researcher, usually they're starting with the alien stuff and they're not even going to get into anything that they're that uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
Because they have to have a high degree of trust with that researcher or with that therapist to get into the deeper aspects. And there's a lot of, I mean, the alien scenario itself has so many levels of aspect.
Oh, yeah.
That you're going to work a while with a therapist before you get into the full sexual part of it, you know,
yeah.
the genetic part of it, into the holding your hybrid baby thing. I mean, that's going to take you a while to even get there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're going to get into those emotional things before you get into the technology stuff, you know. Now, given all that, though, these scenarios do still come up, which is why these researchers have cases of, you know, people who've also had the military stuff. It does come up. It seems to me, you know, like I could say, from as many abduction cases I know, there's a small percentage of overall abduction cases have the military involvement. Well, it makes sense that if Leo's got 600 abductees he's worked with, that 200 have had harassment surveillance and 12 or 15 have had reabduction. I think that to me sounds like a fair representation of the numbers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So in other words, you know, out of a couple thousand abductees, only a couple hundred are going to have the military stuff, you know? And I think that's fair. Or if a million abductees, then only a couple hundred thousand are going to have the military stuff, and then that becomes really hard to go, God, could it be that many, you know?
Yeah.
And so do I get a lot of cases of it? Yes, but people are coming to me. First off, they already know this has happened to them before I hear about them. You know, and I'm known for talking about that, and I emphasize it, and
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
I make a big stink about it. So, so I get, you know, so I get cases referred to me and stuff. But,
exactly. Yeah.
But you know, again, I've talked to most of the, I can't say all, but certainly without doubt, say most of the major abduction researchers, and they all have varying degrees of cases. This depending on their openness to it and their knowledge about it combined. Now, one researcher in particular is not open to it, not that knowledgeable, and tends to see it as something else. But I've even talked to some people that have worked with him that tell me they have this and yet say, you know, I know he's not open to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a shame because you would think, you know, but just because someone's a major abduction researcher doesn't make them a perfect person, you know,
yeah.
by any means. And so, you know, even myself, there's parts of this scenario I am uncomfortable with looking at. You know, I admit that. There's parts of the abduction scenario that I'm uncomfortable with. But, you know, I try to say, okay, what does the evidence say? What are people saying, you know, and try to be true to that and not color it with my own belief system and everything. But, you know, I'm human. I probably do. And so that he would do that is understandable.
Exactly. And it sort of speaks to how we said the abductees are timid to really come forward right away. And so that would kind of take the same mindset, too.
This is the last part. I mean, I can say this unequivocally, you know, with all the cases I've worked with. This is the last part of everything that's happened to them that they're willing to look at, admit to, share with somebody.
Yeah.
Because, remember, we go back to them saying that these experiences are so much worse. There's so much more trauma. There's so much more anger, you know, that, you know, the abductee knows they can't talk about this without getting angry, you know,
kind of
a thing, the rage, you know, kind of stuff. And they often, an abductee doesn't want to share that. They want to appear that they're more okay with their experiences, you know. And so, you know, I mean, I hear about it from people because those people know that I'm open to it, and know they can come to me and know I've worked with other people. And even then, are very guarded, even when they originally tell me, they're going to be like, well, have you ever heard, like I said, they always preface stuff with, have you ever heard of anything like this?
Yeah.
And I'll only like blink and say, yeah, I had 50 people just this year tell me that, you know? You know, but they think they're telling me for the first time because they're certain that they're the only one that's ever had anything that weird, you know?
Exactly. Well, I think as your research gets more out there and publicized, I guess would be the best word maybe, but as your research gets more well known, then hopefully more people will come forward. And that sort of goes to this next question is, like, when you became an activist researcher, did you get a lot of people coming to you? And then how did you deal with, like, all these people coming to you? That must have been just a lot of, like, sorting through people and determining how to deal with all these different experiences.
It's not been that many. First off, too, I also want to say thank you for calling me an activist. Calling me an activist, I think, is like the ultimate compliment.
Oh, well, you are an activist.
That's awesome. No, I do. That's like a compliment. It's not been that many. I mean, you know, truth is, and I'm not even as public as I am about this and doing radio program or whatever, I'm not that extremely public about it. And, you know, I've not done a major thing on television about it or anything like that. So I don't get that many cases. I happen to meet people as I meet them through researchers and through speaking at conferences and stuff, and occasionally people are referred to me. I've only worked with like 50 cases at this point, you know, so it's not that many.
Yeah.
Of people who've had some level of the military involvement stuff. And, I'm familiar with maybe a few more cases because I'm familiar with them, like some of the cases that other researchers have that they've shared with me, or I've heard, you know, whatever, or they've written about, or, you know, so granted, I'm familiar with probably, you know, I've never really sat down and looked at the numbers that closely, but let's say I'm familiar with that many more, twice as many. So if I have 50 cases, I'm probably still familiar with at least another 50 cases that have also had this stuff happen. And, you know, and I'm also not going out trying to increase my numbers. I just kind of, I sit and let things kind of fall at me, if you will, you know.
Yeah, so
if I really started to do some more proactive research about it and going out and searching for it and searching for people with experiences, that could probably dramatically increase. But I don't have the time to do that, you know.
Yeah.
I've got so much to work with the cases that are already referred to me, as an example. And I'm not able, like I said, I had someone referred to me, it's been about 2 months ago, and I still haven't called them, and I need to, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And that kind of thing. So it's not that many cases overall. But within the cases I've had, there have been these consistent patterns that every time I get more cases, the patterns seem to stay consistent, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm open to if something changes. Like I said, this thing with this being involved in military exercises and training and stuff, that is kind of something that's always been there but to a lower degree, and it recently came up in a couple of new cases where it came up in a bigger way. In fact, just one more case that that was referred to me, long story short, but someone I've just spoken to about a week ago on the phone had had that, and I'm like, you know, I've really got to look at that more, because it's kind of been there, and I've just not looked at it for the depth of information that could be there, and I really need to, because I think, like I've already said, can speak volumes.
Yeah.
So you know, that kind of stuff. So as these patterns come up in the research, I've looked at them, and so I've learned different patterns. But it's funny, in all the patterns that have come up, I haven't really had anything come up and then go away. Everything's come up and then kind of remained a pattern. You know,
yeah.
I haven't had something that's like where I had a few cases and then it never came up again. You know. So far, I just become more aware of the kinds of things that can happen, so I hear more of those things, you know.
What would you say as an example of what you're calling, like, patterns?
Well, for instance, like people having that interaction, training, exercise kind of stuff, war game scenario stuff. The few cases where people have said the person put on an alien costume.
Okay, so like,
Patterns of types of experiences. Patterns, you know, initially was, for instance, people seeing aliens present with the military. You know, that was a pattern early on that was like, wait, what's that? You know, and it wasn't there for everyone, but it was there for a few cases.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything consistent about that, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, then there's patterns that come up with everyone, you know. Everyone who has any level of involvement has the phone stuff happen, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
A high majority, not everyone, but a high majority of the people, high percentage of the people have helicopter harassment. They have being befriended, you know. Someone will say, you know, this insider guy, you know, he's wanting to give me this information, and I just roll my eyes and go, yeah, you know, okay, you know, because that happens to all of us, you know. You know, so that kind of thing. So the patterns that are across the board, the follow-up medical procedures, the drugging, the mind control. Oh, my God, the mind control.
Yeah.
That's one area that early on, talk about dragging my feet, not wanting to look at the prevalence of the mind control in this scenario, both to degree of how the mind control is used to manipulate and control the abductee, not only by the U.S., but of course, I mean by the military, how they use it to control, manipulate them, how they use it to cause you to forget, how they use it to influence your behavior, but then that they're also using you as a test subject for developing further mind control techniques, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And these areas, I was so uncomfortable, because it's like the UN costume thing. It's like, this confuses this too much, where people will all say, well, oh, see, it's all mind control.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't want to fall into that category of, you know, oh, it's all mind control, because that wasn't making sense to me. But yet, the procedures and stuff were coming up where it's like, okay, I can't ignore this. It's prevalent. And now it's there in every case. It's a huge part of the research. And it went beyond my, I can't ignore it, to now realizing it's just, it's part and parcel. It's part of it. You know?
Now, speak a little bit more to this minder thing, because that's really creepy. How do these people end up in the lives of the abductees? They just become like their friend, and how does the abductee eventually know that it's a minder and not just their buddy?
That's tricky. Good question. No. Well, first off, it's like when you've met someone who's like an insider, that the way you met them has a strange smell to it, you know,
yeah.
Where it's fishy, you know. And then they're providing you with information, and they're confirming some part of your experience. It's like, and, you know, the abductee doesn't necessarily relate this to, they don't necessarily say, oh, I'm being minded now, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm, you know, they just see it as, you know, oh, hey, they, you know, I've met someone, and they've been able to confirm part of my experience. Isn't that cool? You know?
So they come to them as an insider?
Well, sometimes as an insider, sometimes just as a friend, sometimes as a romantic involvement. Sometimes it's like someone saying, hey, I'm looking out for you. You know, usually it's under the guise of someone that you think is there to help you. You know, they're trying to become a friend of yours. You know, or it may be someone who's been a friend of yours for a while, and suddenly you realize there's this other component to the relationship. And you're like, okay, they knew this about me before I knew it about me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's weird. And, you know, it's such a weird thing that the first time you hear about it from a case, you're like, oh, well, that's interesting, but, okay, this person's just making more out of nothing. You know,
they're paranoid or something.
They're being paranoid, exactly. And then you hear about it from another case, okay, well, that's interesting. Then you hear it from another, and then you hear it from another, and that starts happening to you, and that starts happening to your other friend. And, you know, it's like, okay, you know. And sometimes it's hard for the abductee to put their finger on. You know, these are usually abductees who started to self-investigate, which means you might be attending events and conferences, you know?
Yeah.
And that's usually where you're going to meet this person, is a UFO event or a conference, you know, and you meet them and they're friendly and you realize this is someone who's open to the subject matter. Thank God you have someone in your life who's open to it that you can share part of your experience with. And next thing you know, they're confirming part of it because they say, well, you know, I once worked at this location where, you know, and you say you saw this thing and I can tell you it's there.
Oh,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you're like, yahoo, confirmation. Yet, sometimes the abductee doesn't always see that there might be something kind of interesting there with the fact that this person is in their life, you know.
Yeah.
But, and then, sometimes that can progress, where it can start off as just a helpful thing or someone giving you insight or confirming part of your experience, to suddenly you realize they're manipulating how you think about it. They're manipulating you, whether they encourage you to go public with something or they discourage you from going public.
Yeah.
Or they warn you away from part of it, you know, and that's when it starts where the abductee goes, wait a second, this person's manipulating me in this way. They're trying to steer me away from this or steer me towards something.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, does that minor relationship ever come to a head where the person confronts them?
Oh, yeah.
And what's that? How's that going?
Well, usually the minders disappear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when that happens. I mean, yeah, that's happened in a couple cases. You know. Suddenly you find that this person's not around as much and not bothering you. And, oh, yeah. Because sometimes the abductees, talk about the rage.
Yeah.
When you feel that someone is in your life and they're manipulating you or controlling you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There can be some rage. And the abductee usually says buzz off in, you know, not so polite terms. But,
yeah.
You know, and starts not taking their phone calls, ignoring them. And these people go away, you know, when they're, but in one, well, more than one or two, in a couple of cases, the abductee later has realized someone else surfaced to replace that person.
Oh, really?
And usually they realized it later, like, you know, I had this person, they went away, and then I had this other person later, and I didn't realize it for a long time because they were sneakier the second time around, and then I realized, wait a second, this is someone else, you know.
Yeah.
And again, this is really rare. I mean, it's more likely you're going to have the reabduction and be aware of that long before you're aware of this part. But yet it's come up, and I've had multiple cases have it happen, including myself. And sometimes, and this is the other thing that's really weird. It's not always a bad thing. Sometimes it appears that that this is someone who is actually there to somewhat confirm part of your scenario. It seems that there are different factions within the cover-up guys, within the cover-up cabal, where there are those that are wanting to get certain amounts of the information out,
mm-hmm.
and those that don't. And those that maybe want to get it out but want to spin it and control it in a certain way, like controlled disclosure.
Yeah.
You know, the word disclosure. Controlled disclosure in a certain way. And there, so what you have when you meet these guys are guys that totally want to covered up, steer you away from it and scare you away from it. And then you have guys that totally want to confirm and validate and encourage you. And then you have guys that are encouraging you but leaning you in a certain direction, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, so abductees report all these different scenarios to me, and sometimes more than one scenario at the same time.
Oh, really?
And then sometimes, like, one of their minders looks, they start to figure out that one of their minders is trying to steer them away from another minder.
Oh, man.
Like, you have minder versus minder.
Oh, jeez.
it gets very confusing to the abductee, because they're sometimes they're just never really completely sure. But I hear the same scenarios repeated to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's one of those things, it's one of those areas that requires further research. But there is this, you know, it's mind games. It's all mind games. And you know, usually this person is befriending them, where usually it's a supportive thing. So, you know, it's not negative. Even if it's that they're trying to steer you in a certain direction, they're usually doing so as your friend. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so a couple times there's been, there have been some more negative scenarios where, for instance, I can think of two right off the bat, two different abductees who had super-duper, like, stalker scenarios, like, threats on their life, you know. And that in both cases, this person seemed to have inside knowledge about their experience, no details about it, and yet be very menacing in their life.
Oh, man.
You know, I mean, threatening them,
yeah.
You know, threaten their life,
yeah.
and sometimes even act out to some degree.
Oh, geez.
So it can be like that. Thank God that's rare.
Yeah. Now tell me a little bit about your co-author and the co-author's story, because you sort of alluded to that in your notes, your presentation and stuff. Were you working on a book at the time, or was this just a co-researcher?
Well, I've kind of been on and off for like the last somewhere between 5 and 10 years, on and off, working on a book. I kind of started one, compiling stuff, chapter headings, you know, plugging stuff in slowly, and still am. And I've had a number of life obstacles come up that have constantly been putting it on the shelf.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do. I have a certain amount of emotional blocks. I'll admit that to doing it, you know, because of my own experience. But I've continued, and at one time, another abductee who had all this kind of same stuff and was looking into it, and who was a friend of mine, had considered doing a book, and we started talking. We said, well, let's do it together, and that way we'll spur each other on, you know, encourage each other.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened, and we started to work, and we went public with the fact we were doing this together, and we started doing presentations together and this kind of thing. We both had, when you start to be more public with it, and this happens with me, if I increase the number of presentations and stuff I'm doing, and I go through periods where I do a bunch, and I go through periods where I don't do any, and radio and this and that, but if I'm doing a lot, and if it's national and it's big, you know, then I tend to have some harassment surveillance stuff. I expect it. You know, it's like, okay, they're going to show up now. You know?
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, I accept that that could happen. Mm-hmm. It's a risk of being public with it. But, and I accept a certain amount of risk, you know. Because I've also learned that they're mostly just threatening and annoying, and it's, you know, it's like, okay, you guys, it's just more evidence, you know, go bring it on. You know?
Yeah. It's not, you're on the right track, I guess.
It's not a concern. It's, you know, I don't feel my life is truly threatened or anything like that. I think
that's good.
Me. I don't know. That sounds crazy, but, you know. But in her case, anyways, she started to have stuff happen. We both did, especially after a major national, or actually international radio broadcast. And with her, we both started to have an increase in activity. I expected it. She did too. We weren't necessarily surprised. But then with her, in fact, we had something 2 days after the radio program where the two of us were abducted together and had a major re-abduction. with both of us taken together.
Oh, man.
And very intense, and lots of physical evidence, and, you know, just the whole gamut of the severe kind of experience. And witness to what happened to each other. And also a lot of physical evidence. They broke down her door and damaged her door frame. We were taken, I was staying at her place. We were both taken from her apartment, and they damaged the front door and the lock and the door frame, and, you know, breaking into the house to get us and,
yeah,
you know, and this kind of thing. And damaged some furniture, and, you know, so it was pretty rough. And anyhow, she then continued to have stuff happen, and eventually it escalated, and it escalated to the point, there were many kind of final things that happened, but one of them, I'll give one scenario, was she was doing a little bit of, I think, some internet dating, and had met someone on the internet, and had had some good experiences with that, and, you know, was cautious and,
yeah,
and adult and doing it in an intelligent way. Well, she had someone that she developed a relationship with, and she had a date with them, and this was their first meeting. She shows up to meet this guy at a restaurant, and he shows up, and he's wearing a partial military uniform. He's wearing, like, jeans, but he has a military top on,
yeah,
you know, with insignia and stuff, you know, pretty, and has a military haircut.
Yeah.
And she sits down, and she's a little bit concerned about that, but not completely concerned, because she's like, well, you didn't say you were in the military, but okay, you know, I know now, you know. And she sits down at the table with him, and he proceeds to tell her some details about her experience, that she'd obvious, you know, that he had to have known something to have known that, because she never, you know, shared that,
yeah,
with anyone, and certainly not with him. And then he proceeded to say, I'm here to tell you to not go forward with your research and to drop this and to not talk about it. And she's like, okay, well, you know, I've heard this before. You know,
yeah.
She's had a lot of stuff happen. And he proceeded to tell her details about her sons. She had two grown sons. Details of where they lived, what they did each day, where they worked, what time they left for work, how they drove there, how they came home.
So all
their kids knew everything about them, like they'd been monitoring them closely for a period of time.
Yeah.
Complete lifestyle, like. And he said, no, you don't get it. You're to drop this or your sons will be hurt, period.
Oh,
and man. And was made it very clear that they were monitoring the sons at close range.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, her sons had no idea. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And said, we will hurt them.
Oh, man.
You know, and it was obvious to her that they had the ability to grab them at any time, you know, I mean, because they were obviously monitoring them that closely.
Yeah.
And that combined with everything, so it wasn't the final thing. Actually, I'll tell you what the final thing was. When I gave this stalking scenario, she was one of them.
Yeah.
And she had had a stalker situation where the guy knew details. This was months later. This was months and months later after that date even, where this stalker thing became very bad. And this person, in fact, the police ended up telling her, because she was able to get a license plate on the car from this guy, and they were able to find out who this guy was. And they said, this person has a record. He's done time for rape and child molestation.
Oh, Jesus.
And so the police said, you need to take this very seriously. And they even suggested that she move from where she currently lived. And that became a very real, real threat to her.
Oh, yeah.
And so, And then, like that wasn't enough, her car was forced off the road by another car and witnessed by a truck driver who witnessed this and gave a police report saying he saw her car forced off the road by this other car. So multiple things happened to her that it became too much. The point when they forced her off the road, she got in a horrible car accident. And at this point, she said, they made an attempt on my life, and
Yeah, at that point, you got to be like,
it was actually a series of attempts or near attempts on her that, and that was kind of like the final straw.
Nothing like that happened to you? Not like a near?
Nowhere near that extreme. I had low grade stuff and then it subsided. And everyone said, well, why is it happening to her and not to you? In retrospect, I have reason to believe that there was more mind control in her life going back. It's a long story, and I don't wish to really get into it in the sake of this interview because it's very private for her. Mm-hmm. But there's a pattern and a history of being used. It's hard to put the finger on, but there is a pattern and a history that suggests she was used in a specific mind control program for a period of her life, maybe going back into her childhood, but in her 20s for about a 10-year period. That I think as she started to self-investigate about her experiences, we were doing the research together, she needed, for us to be able to address in our research the mind control aspect of it, she needed to understand more about what had happened to herself. So she started to get regressions for that period of time in her life and start to piece together some scenarios regarding, I can say this much, regarding an ex-husband and his involvement in a program, and I think they didn't want her looking into that anymore.
Yeah, they couldn't afford her investigating much more.
Looking into that. And so I think that is why she had it worse than I did. To me, that's the only thing that makes sense. And when she dropped out and she's remained out, they have
let her alone.
They have let her alone. I think from time to time, she maybe has had a little bit of very low-grade stuff, but it's just kind of to remind her, and they've left her alone. So in her case, they got to her, and it worked, and they've left her alone, and she feels happy that she's able to get on with her life.
Well, that's good.
Luckily. So, yes, she's fine, and everything's going well for her, but she won't touch the UFO subject with a 10-foot pole.
Well, that's sort
of... won't even go near it, and she even separates herself... And unfortunately, she had a lot of major friends in the field and has had to separate herself from those friends.
That's too bad.
But Over time, there are a few people she's been able to remain in contact with, but very few. Yeah, it's very, very sad. It's very, very sad. People often ask me if it got that bad for you, And I said, well, I don't know how I'd react. But thank God it's not gotten that bad.
I know.
But like I said, I think it had to do with this ex-husband of hers and his past involvement in something that I think they didn't want her looking into.